So, Paul, let's back up here a little bit. Where, in your opinion, did this flight first go wrong?
Wichita, 1956, or whenever the 210 gear was originally designed. The Cessna gears have proven problematical in service. And I've looked at the service difficulty reports and in the study I did on gear-up landings. The 210 represented 25% of the total, but it representing something like 4% of the total population. The problem is partially designed because it's not designed for maintenance, but the big issue is maintenance. People don't maintain the gear systems. They don't swing them as often as they should. The parts can be difficult and expensive to get, and people cut corners, and this is what happens. And it's very common. Probably see a dozen of these a year, maybe more. And we don't hear about them all because not all of them make it into the NTSB record.
Well, no, that's actually an interesting bit there. You said not all of them make it into the NTSB records, that a gear-up landing, I mean, this is going to cause, you know, potentially totaling damage to the airplane, right, is not even going to make it into the NTSB records. And I can see, Tom, go ahead.
Well, that's because the only accident reporting requirement we have is NTSB 830. Technically, there's nothing that requires us to report any mishaps to the FAA itself, just to the NTSB. NTSB 830 is one of the shortest regulations I've seen, and it includes a statement, and to paraphrase it, I don't have it precisely in front of me, it says that anything that causes a certain level of damage is required to be reported unless that damage is limited to, and it lists a number of things, propeller, lower belly skin, landing gear components. It describes precisely a gear-up landing. So gear-up landings are essentially immune from any reporting requirement. My personal feeling is those gear-up landings that we hear about in the FAA reports and subsequently in the NTSB report are the result of someone who doesn't know they don't have to report it, making a report, and then the FAA is obligated to follow up on it. So I know from sources in the Beechcraft world that the rate of actual gear mishaps is at least 4 to 5 times that we see reflected in the NTSB report and all of the studies that are based on NTSB data.
Well, in the continuing saga of terrible decisions and potentially terrible decisions here, I saw you, Dave, kind of snickering at part of what this pilot did earlier on in the flight in terms of the gear system, pushing back in of the breaker, right? You want to talk about that for just a moment?
Yeah, I mean, that's just a big red flag. If the breaker is popping, it's doing so for a reason. You know, the aviation gods gave him one chance to address it. It didn't, you know, obviously didn't take that chance.
Well, I'm gonna challenge that for a second here because, I mean, he reset the breaker on the maintenance flight, put the gear down, and the gear came down. Problem solved. And then the plane went back in for maintenance. Presumably they mentioned something about that, right? And then he took the plane back, put the gear up, the gear came up. So the next time it happened, kind of an issue. The breaker popped. It worked last time. It works this time. Would you have done something differently in that second situation? He's flying back home after flying for an hour, puts it down, the breaker pops again.
Yeah, well, I mean, maybe we'll cut him some slack if maintenance was done or attempted after the first breaker pop. But it's like the airplane's trying to tell you something. You know, take heed.
Would anyone else have pushed that breaker back in the second time on that? You know, you're in the air. Supposedly it was fixed. It seems like a pretty reasonable thing to do. How do you make those kind of decisions? You're kind of nodding your head back and forth, Bruce. You're
there's clearly sure. A history here of some kind of problem, and we don't really know what maintenance was done, who did the maintenance, what they really looked at. So I'm reluctant to press my luck on playing with circuit breakers.
The other problem is if you get in the habit of pushing circuit breakers in, one of those days it's really going to get you into trouble. So this person had the habit of pushing it in, and so it's really hard once you've pushed them in to stop yourself from doing it again. But I would ask, how big is the breaker? Is it a 5 or a 10, or is it a landing
probably
gear?
Probably a 20.
20.
Yeah.
Oh.
Maybe a 30.
It's a big one.
I'm
yeah.
really surprised he even pushed it back in, and I get hesitant.
Well, having some corporate knowledge of the 210 would help, too, because the 210 does have such a history of gear problems, and they are related to electrical and hydraulic issues, so it's something that you really do want to check out if you have even the slightest doubt about it. And no matter how much maintenance you do on it, it won't be enough.
You know, one assumption that we make here is that there is insurance. You keep saying, hey, the insurance company owns it. It's up to the insurance company. Would your actions be any different if it wasn't insured?
No, because you are after survivability here. So, and I mentioned why there's no advantage to landing with one down. We can't think of an advantage of doing that. There's no advantage to landing in the dirt or the grass because there's a remote possibility of a pitch pole, and that's going to do more damage if you're self-insured, but it could cause injuries.
One thing the scenario doesn't address is what's the manual extension process? What's the checklist say? I'm always telling folks, if I ever have an emergency, an in-flight emergency, I hope it's a landing gear problem because it's not usually an immediate, I got to do something right now situation. I've got time, assuming I have some fuel and I'm not in icing conditions or something, to take a moment, follow the checklist, and try that procedure rather than trying to cycle gear up and down with a bulky motor or hydraulic system or both. That's my first step on these, is to follow the procedure.
Yeah, Bruce is exactly right. The 210 landing gear is hydraulically activated. It has an electric motor that runs the hydraulic pump. So the circuit breaker popping is a function of a failed motor, not a failed hydraulic system. The next thing to do would be to do the manual landing gear extension procedure, which, if I remember, you pull out a handle and you give it about 20 pumps, and the landing gear goes down if the hydraulic system is intact. So you have that whole second response here to an electrical problem and the hydraulic way to get around it.
Right, and that's part of knowing your systems and understanding your airplane and not, as you said earlier, Paul, snatching defeat from the jaws of victory, actually creating a situation that's worse.
You know, Paul, you mentioned that there's really no advantage to landing with one main down or landing on the grass. So my question is, what about flaps and configuration? I would think in a high-wing airplane, putting flaps down and landing as normal would be the way to go, but I don't have a lot of low-wing experience. So what about if in this situation with a low-wing airplane, do you land gear up, you put the flaps down, or keep them up?
Yeah, flaps down. You're going to have some flap damage, but the key thing is you're going to land slowly. So you do want to minimize that slide just because. The sooner you stop, the better off you are. So I wouldn't, again, it's to minimize damage, I wouldn't land flaps up. I'd make it just a normal landing. And the only thing that's abnormal about it, other than the gear being in the wells, is to just remember to pull the mixture as you touch down.
Now, you mentioned, Paul, you wouldn't necessarily go hunting for a place that had crash and rescue for this kind of a situation. You know, how do you kind of run through that in your head? What's worth it and what isn't? Why wouldn't you, if you had time and fuel, like stuff could go wrong, go somewhere where there definitely was crash and rescue? And then how would you find it?
Well, like we say, it's a coin toss. And if you're landing at your home airport, you know what the facilities are, and say it has CFR, okay, have them standing by, please. If it doesn't, and an airport 25 miles away does, well, you can determine that by looking in the chart supplement, and it'll tell you what's available, when it's available. It's likely to be a Part 139 airport, I think, and they'll have it available. And if you think you want to cover all bases, then it makes sense.
And if you have time, it might make sense to go to an airport with more than one runway. I was recently just inconvenienced by flying in toward an airport where somebody wasn't gear up, but he had a flat tire. He couldn't get off the only runway available. So I know I had to divert because it was a quiet little airport. They weren't going to get him clear anytime soon. So again, you have options here, assuming there's nothing else wrong with the airplane. And crash, fire, rescue is one good option, but also if there's a nearby airport where you can land without disrupting everything, that might be a consideration.
I'd be tempted to go back to the airport where this work was done in the first place and belly it in right there.
Fix it.
Slide it right into the hangar.
Yeah. And also I have no actual experience with this, but I remember being told once by a fellow pilot was given the option of, do you want foam on the runway? And he said, yeah, sure, why not? And he said that all it caused him to do was to slide off the runway at a high rate of speed, so no foam. He said if he had it to do over again, don't take that option.
Yeah, many people think that the function of the foam is to somehow cushion the landing. Actually, it's a fire retardant, and the correct thing to do is have them foam fairly far down the runway, your goal is to come to a stop in that, not to land on it, but to come to a stop in it. Very few places will foam anymore, and it's very expensive, and you will get billed if they do. But it's not there to cushion the landing. It's there to prevent fire once the airplane stops.
Given how short you're going to stop, I just have this vision of a big pile of foam and the airplane sliding to a stop about 100 feet before it, you know?
Well, the 310 that I mentioned in the response, that's exactly what happened. It was in Hagerstown, Maryland. They had foam because it Fairchild was there. They were building A-10s. They foamed the runway. The pilot didn't ask for it, so he landed in the grass, and it was a poor choice.
I think in the category of things not to do, I wouldn't go out and burn a bunch of gas. I think some people may have that tendency to think, oh, we got to go out and loiter and burn gas, and I just think of the 2 hours I'm sitting there thinking about this landing that is imminent. And also, I think the chance, if you do it right with all the gear in the wells, the chance for fire is pretty minimal in this scenario. So I also wouldn't go out and burn gas.
Yeah, and that makes sense, too, in terms of how long you're sitting there thinking about it and worrying about it. I suppose the flip side, if anyone wants to come in, is getting someone on the ground on the horn who may have some idea that you didn't. Now, maybe they're going to suggest you do a real high G-loading to pop the wheel out, and maybe that's a bad idea. But you mentioned that video, Paul, in your expert response of the 17-year-old on a solo cross-country. For people who are listening to this, it's actually pretty interesting to sit and listen to it because she's, you know, initially kind of panicked flying around. You can hear her on the verge of tears, and the controller talks to her for a little bit, just keeps her flying around the pattern. By the time her instructor comes on, she's calmer. By the time the instructor has talked about the landing and said it's going to be a straightforward landing, she's completely confident on the radio. And that time that she was lingering may have had a factor in that successful outcome, you know, just to kind of calm down and do it correctly and normally on top of all those things.
And one other temptation is to either do, you know, multiple low passes trying to see if the gear is down, or even worse, an impromptu formation flight. Your buddy's up flying around, hey, Bob, come over and, you know, get close to me and see what you see. And unless you know what you're really doing, there have been several accidents related to this kind of behavior, and it's really not a good idea.
Let's talk a little bit about just maintenance flights in general. I mean, this is an airplane that has come out of not minor maintenance, but a, you know, tail to spinner rebuild. And there have been test flights, but there have been issues too. I wonder if anyone wants to just address that. I know that's something you've talked about, Tom, many times.
Yeah, quite a bit. It is very much a production test flight, similar to when the airplane was originally manufactured. Now, I don't know to the extent in the scenario that was done, because there was talk about going up and flying off the rest of the squawks. There may have been a significant amount of flight time on it on the airplane after all of this work was completed, but there might not have been as well. And going a little farther away from the specific scenario, a very common situation we see in mishap reports is where somebody gets the airplane out of annual inspection or out of a modification or, worse yet, out of the avionics shop from a major avionics upgrade, and then they take off into low instrument conditions and something isn't working right and they end up crashing. There's a certain amount of time and effort that needs to be put into ensuring that the airplane is completely airworthy. And in the case of something like the 210, you might contact a type club or somebody who might have a checklist that you would actually use. I'm aware of them. In my world, we have a post-maintenance flight checklist that we suggest our members use to go through all of the systems. Certainly an airplane that has gone through this extensive renovation or resuscitation even needs to go through some significant testing before you just take it back home.
Just an insurance question, really, is the pilot in this scenario likely to face any insurance ramifications? Are his rates going to go up because he makes a claim? What sort of comeuppance is likely to follow this?
Not too likely in the current insurance market, because we discussed this earlier, that it's a soft market. There's a lot of competition. And for an insurance company, this is daily business. This kind of stuff goes on all the time. They're not too worried about metal bending accidents so much as they are high liability where death or injury is involved. So it wouldn't be surprising to me if this had no impact on this pilot's insurance. And I mentioned our Cub, the insurance company covered everything, and our insurance premium went down $300.
Went down $300.
Yeah, and
the airplane wasn't worth as much.
Well, I think it's just related to the market, and they're just not as sensitive as we tend to think they are. Nor are they likely to look at this and find, oh, you forgot to replace the trunnion bushing, therefore we're not going to pay the claim. That doesn't happen very often, if it happens at all.
I find it interesting that when you bring up the Cub, that it actually doesn't make a big difference, you know, in terms of having both wheels up or one wheel down. And I'm glad you brought it up, just because we don't have as many people flying retracts, especially in GA anymore, but that you still have the issue potentially with, you know, just a tire that goes flat on takeoff. You hit a piece of FOD on the runway and you have that issue. If you know you're going to have an atypical landing, let's call it, with an issue, what do you do to prepare yourself, and what do you do to prepare other people? If then this person was alone, but what if there had been other people on board? It's going to make a lot of noise, and it's not going to be pretty. How do you get people ready for that?
Obviously, you brief the passengers. You might do the normal sort of forced landing checklist items, like making sure a door is opened. And as Paul mentioned, you want to make sure that you shut down the engine as soon as practical.
And although historically the danger is very slight, there still is a fire hazard there. So you do want to brief your passengers that as soon as the airplane comes to a stop and you tell them to, you'll evacuate the aircraft. You really do need to get away from it.
And you need to be specific about how you're going to evacuate right. The airplane.
Yeah,
who gets out first? Where do you go?
Yeah, depending on the number of doors and the location exactly. Part of my briefing when I get into an airplane with a passenger is that if we need to evacuate the aircraft, you will go first because of the type I fly. It has a door on the right-hand side. You'll go out of the airplane first. I will go out next. We'll talk about passengers in the back if needed. But all of us, when you get out of the aircraft, you're going to go toward the tail and keep on going. The objective is to get away from the engine and the wings as much as possible. We'll meet about 100 feet behind the airplane unless you feel you need to go farther than that.
And you know, one of the beauties of thinking about something like that is a non-standard, non-normal briefing, but something that you should have on your, you know, emergency sheet or in your mind to pull out at that moment to cover all the things that are really different about this. But one of the things I like about this scenario is it feels like a big, nasty, gnarly emergency, kind of one of the fears when you're flying a retractable gear airplane. And yet around the table, we have consensus that the thing to do to deal with it is just keep doing what you would normally do. Normalize, 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 and do the small things that you need to hedge against, you know, some kind of a bad outcome, but not make it any worse by trying to be some kind of hero.